T-shirts, sweatshirts, socks, and coffee mugs.
But it's also very aesthetically gripping.
To keep you styling in support of the station you love. Isn't that right, Jonathan?
Well, actually, is it? Because, I mean, you know, I was going to say because of the cultural vacuum that we exist within, but then, you know, really, fashion today is kind of derived from the European idea of couture, and that's been around for centuries.
This is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territory on the University of British Columbia campus. Hello, and welcome to Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and today we are speaking with a return guest to Synchronicity, Eric Maisel. Dr. Eric Maisel is the author of more than 40 books, which is probably why he's been on the show before. His interests include creativity, the creative life, and the field of creativity coaching, which he actually founded, and the areas of meaning, life purpose, mental health, and mental health reform, which are all important to Synchronicity. So thank you so much for being with us today, Eric.
Hi, Marie. It's great to be with you.
Thank you. And your latest book, that's what we're here to talk about today, is Overcoming Your Difficult Family, 8 Skills for Thriving in Any Family Situation. So I'm curious, did you have a difficult family, or what inspired you to write this book?
I didn't have a difficult family after about the first 5 years of life. I grew up in the Bronx in one of those extended crazy-making families with, you know, lots of nutty siblings and aunts and uncles and the whole thing. But my mom and I moved out to Brooklyn when I was about 5 years old, and then we had a very quiet life thereafter, just the two of us. And so I grew up in really in a very quiet environment all the way through thereafter, and my own personal life has been good, knock on wood, since then. It was more noticing my friends' lives, and especially when their dads would come home at 5 or 6 and how all hell would break loose and the tyranny would start, the sort of the everyday tyranny at the dining room table, that sort of thing. And I actually felt blessed and lucky not to have one of those big families. I was very happy just being alone with my mom, getting to read books and relax and be quiet.
Thank you. Yeah, I grew up in foster care, and then my mom passed on in my 20s, and I always had this sadness around not having family and sort of being almost an orphan. But then I would go see other people's families and living in other people's families and seeing how dysfunctional they could be. There were a lot of times I actually felt very blessed to not have family.
Yeah, you know, and I was an avid reader growing up, and one of the things I read when I was very young, maybe 8 years old, was Sartre's autobiography, Les Mots, and he talks in it about growing up with his mom without a dad and how he always felt blessed not to, in his words, have a father lay full length on him. And I think that, you know, just if you're a little kid, dads are so big, mm-hmm. apart from anything they may be doing to you, but they're just so, these adults are such looming physical presences. But at any rate, I agree with you. I was happy the way I grew up.
Well, I'm really glad that you wrote the book, even though you were happy with the way you grew up. You saw people, I would imagine, not only your friends, but people in your coaching practice who come from difficult families. So I'm wondering if maybe you can give us just a quick summary of what those 8 skills might be, and then we can talk a little bit about them.
Sure. And let me just back up a little bit and give a little more of the history to explain where I'm coming from. When I got out of the Army, I got a degree in philosophy, which is one of those things you do when you don't know what you're doing. But I did enjoy existential philosophy. And for the longest time, forever, really, I've believed in the ideas of personal responsibility and the other ideas that existentialism promote. Then I worked as a writer, both as a ghostwriter, and I wrote my own fiction for a long time, but not enough money came in. So I retooled as a California family therapist. That was my license. And I began working with creative couples and creative families because creative individuals interested me. But very quickly, I stopped believing in the underlying therapy model, the paradigm that I was diagnosing and treating mental disorders. I thought I was just working with folks who were troubled and facing the everyday challenges of living. So I moved out of therapy into coaching, which actually didn't even quite exist. We're talking about 30 years ago. First, I moved to something I called creativity consulting, and then to creativity coaching when the word coaching became popular. But throughout this time, I've been interested in my artist client families, not just in their individual lives and challenges, but in their families and just how difficult family life can be for them. But apart from that, one reason I wanted to write this book is that we're at this moment in cultural history, human history, first world history anyway, where everybody thinks about individual pathology, that people have caught something, clinical depression or generalized anxiety disorder, or if you're a kid, ADHD or oppositional defiant disorder or something. And we've completely lost the idea of context and circumstances, completely lost the idea that a child might be influenced by his parents fighting every day at the dining room table. Psychiatrists now spend on average with a new patient 15 minutes. What can go on then except a kind of checklist investigation of what's going on, no real investigation? So one of the reasons I wanted to return to thinking about family life was to remind folks context and circumstances matter, and what may be bothering you may not be, so to speak, individual pathology, but rather the situation and the circumstances you find yourself in. So that's a little bit of the background as to why I wanted to write a book about families, not just because families are influential and important, but because people are thinking so much about individual pathology and so little about how the people around them are affecting them.
Thank you, Eric. Yeah, I'm glad you shared that, because it sounds like it's not only families. I mean, you might have a work family where you go and you spend 40 or 60 hours a week with those people, and then you go home and you spend time with your home family, and each group of people that you spend a lot of time with is going to impact how you feel, how you view the world.
Yep, and let's call it a cultural family. How many people come home and turn on the news and watch what's going on in the world to their distress and dismay? There's that too, and that's influential too. I think a lot of people have been, you know, knocked for a loop by the last year of politics, and to act as if that isn't influential obviously misses the boat, because it is influential.
Absolutely. So I'm wondering if you can go over, I mean, in the book it covers the 8 skills, but just for like summary's sake, what are the 8 skills?
Yeah, and before I mention them, I do want to say that I don't believe that anybody can learn 8 skills. I think that's beyond human endurance to actually tackle 8 things. So although I'm presenting 8 skills, I really feel that if a reader would work on one that matters to her or that strikes her as the place she needs the most work, that would be great. Just working on one would be terrific. So although I'm going to mention 8. As I say, I don't really believe anybody can work on 8 different things. It's a little much. But the 8 skills are smarts, and that's the first one. And that's just really being observant and understanding what's going on in your family and doing some problem solving, trying to decide what might be the smart thing to do given what's actually going on. Had a client who had a newly retired husband, and she was a writer, and she worked at home, and he kept wandering into her space, and it didn't matter what she said, he was just always curious what she was doing, and was she possibly free for golf or whatever. And instead of just brooding about it or being upset with him, which is what she was doing to begin with, she employed her smarts and realized that she would go, even though this wasn't her first choice, but she would go out and start working in a cafe and in libraries and in places out of the home. Even though she had a perfectly fine study at home, being at home wasn't working, wasn't smart to be there. So that's what I mean by smarts, is problem solving. Because often we're faced by a problem where there is a solution that isn't so dramatic as a divorce or sort of upending everything. Well, we have to find some patience and calmness in order to find those kinds of solutions and manifest our smartness. Then the second skill I call strength. And by that I mean these things that go on in families tire us out. It's hard to watch our son over drinking for the 100th time or, you know, have our mate show up late for the 1,000th time. These things really exhaust us to keep seeing them and enduring them. And it takes strength to deal with them each new time, because we're not talking about something happening only once in life. We're talking about repeated things happening. That's what family life is about, the same thing going on time and time again. And that requires strength to deal with. The third skill is the skill of calmness. So much of what bothers human beings has to do with our early warning system around danger, namely anxiety. So much of what goes on makes us anxious, and then we have to deal with all of that anxiety. And what that means is we really need to learn some useful and portable anxiety management tools that we can use when we're actually feeling anxious. I want to say as a parenthesis here, I hope I can return to the main thread. I hope I don't lose myself here, but I have a pretty simple model of personality as personality being made up of three parts. And the first part is what I call original personality. And that's our natural endowments. That's the way we come into the world already. And, you know, anybody who's had kittens or puppies or kids knows that every creature comes into the world already itself. There's the more antic one and the more Buddha-like one. And every creature is different. And what that may mean, and there's no reason to suppose it doesn't mean this, is that an individual may have come into the world already a little sadder than the next person or a little more anxious than the next person. Psychology pays zero attention to this idea, zero attention. Psychology makes believe that everybody starts from the same place and then follows some developmental scheme and maybe gets blocked in development, etc., as if everyone starts from the same place, which just doesn't make any sense to me. But what this means is you may have been born. Let me put another parenthesis on the parenthesis, and that is you may remember from the Middle Ages that thinkers, natural philosophers of the Middle Ages, believed that all human beings came in one of four flavors. One, they called them humors. And one of those humors was melancholia. They felt a full quarter of the human race came into the world already sad. And I think this is important for where we are. Not everything or not anything, perhaps, is clinical depression. It may be that we've come into the world a little sadder than the next person or a little more anxious than the next person. These then don't become mental disorders. They do become lifelong challenges, however. And that's why really practicing the skill of calmness may be so important for an individual, because not only may your family be making you anxious and life be making you anxious, and by the way, if you're a creative person, the creative life and the creative act making you anxious, you may even have been born a little more anxious than the next person. That's why I'm paying special attention to this skill, because I think that calmness is really one of the most important things we can learn for ourselves. Then the fourth skill I call clarity, which is just getting a better sense of what's going on, really understanding what's going on, and it connects to the fifth skill of awareness. They're related skills. The sixth skill is what I'm calling courage, and it takes a lot of courage even to speak up in families, because speaking up often produces consequences, consequences we may not really want, consequences like a fight or a divorce or a rupture among siblings, or rather dramatic things happen when we actually say what we need to say in family life. And that's why courage is required to do that speaking. And also courage is required to face the fact that there will be genuine consequences to speaking. The seventh skill I'm calling presence, and that's the ability to stay put in these interactions. Rather than sort of darting by the person you're having trouble with in your family, at some point, the two of you have to have a certain kind of conversation, probably instigated by you, and talk about what's going on. And that requires a lot of presence. And just as a parenthesis there, kind of the best way to manifest that presence is to rehearse those kinds of interactions. I find I do a lot of rehearsing with clients, and I find that not only can they figure out what they want to say to the other person in their mind's eye, but they also know what the other person is going to say. They've been living with this person forever, and they can predict what the other person is going to say in response to what they say. So I find that clients can have like both sides of the conversation and really get pretty prepared, and then they need the presence to actually have the real conversation with the other person. And then lastly, the eighth skill is resilience. And by that, I mean an obvious thing, which is we need to not deal with these issues one time, but over and over again, because these are people we live with and we're going to see from the beginning of time to the end of time. Actually, siblings may be the most of all, because with siblings, we're born at roughly the same time and travel our whole lives together with those siblings. And so if we're having some problem with a sibling, we're going to really need resilience, because we're going to be having that problem over and over again with that person. So that's just a little bit on those eight skills.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Are you starting fresh this year and looking for new, exciting activities to do with friends on campus? Did you watch theater in high school and now miss it? Feeling overwhelmed and need a break? Come and escape to another world through thrilling live performance right on campus. Celebrate with us the 60th anniversary of UBC Theater and Film's 2018-19 season. Still need more convincing? It's only $11.50 for UBC students with your card, and bring your ticket into Kerner's after the show to get 10% off your food. Check out theaterfilm.ubc.ca today.
Right now, we are speaking with Eric Maisel, and we're talking about his latest book, Overcoming Your Difficult Family, Eight Skills for Thriving in Any Family Situation. And I love that you mentioned, before you went into all the skills, you said, suggested picking just one skill to really work on at a time, because it can get really overwhelming to try and be working on everything else.
Yeah, most people don't really want to work on themselves. That's not saying anything disrespectful about any individual. It's just about the species. You know, we find it hard to institute new habits, even if we know we ought to be instituting them. We find it hard to break repetitive patterns. We find it hard to, and this should be easier because as soon as I say it, people get why they should be doing it. We even find it hard to think thoughts that serve us. You'd think that we'd get to the place as individuals where at least we could do what the Buddha said, namely get a grip on our mind and think thoughts that serve us. But most people are really held hostage by their thoughts. They're not actively doing that thing of getting a grip on their mind, but rather thinking thoughts that aren't serving them very well. And although we're slightly off topic, I would like to just stay here for one second, because the way I'm saying this is important to me. Because it's not about the truth or falsity of a thought. Most people think that if a thought is true, then somehow they're obliged to countenance it. They're obliged to think it. And they're not. We only need to be thinking thoughts that serve us, not thoughts that are true. I'll give you a simple example from my creativity coaching life. If you're a writer and you walk into a bookstore and you see all these books and you just kind of casually think, wow, there are a lot of writers out there. That's a true thought. Can't dispute the veracity of that. There are a lot of writers out there. But that's not a thought that serves that writer to be thinking. And what will typically happen is you walk into that bookstore on a Monday, and on Thursday you stop writing, and you haven't anywhere in conscious awareness made the connection that because you thought that thought about how much competition there is and maybe how far behind you are and how little you've gotten accomplished and all of that, that now you've stopped working. So we have to be very careful about what we're thinking and really noticing if a given thought is serving us. As I say, that's a high bar place to set the bar, but I think it's the appropriate place, because we just live much more happily and much more purposefully if we do that job of thinking thoughts that serve us.
Oh, that's really valuable, I'm sure, for many people listening. I know for myself, that's, yeah, if a thought seems true, then it seems important and it seems like something that I should consider and maybe even act on, when what could be the result of that is hopelessness, giving up, just not even trying in the first place. And I'm wondering, though, you say that we don't have to think the thoughts just because it's true. We don't have to think that thought.
Yep.
But because so few of us actually have a good grasp on how to not think those thoughts, because as soon as we think, well, I don't want to think that thought anymore, that's, what do they say, the white elephant.
Yeah.
You know, that's all we can think about once we start to push it away. So what do people do instead of thinking that thought?
Well, I think it's the way we push it away that helps. So the first cognitive therapist teaches simple three-step process, and it's a process that will work if people will try it. The first step is to hear what you're saying, to hear that thought, because we only half hear the things we're saying because we're pretty tricky creatures and we don't want to notice what we're saying often. For instance, if I'm a writer and I'm trying to find reasons for not getting to my writing because writing is actually harder than turning on the TV or checking my email. So I might say something to myself like, wow, I'm tired, or wow, I'm busy. And because both of those thoughts have lots of truth to them, everybody is busy and lots of people are tired, we immediately let ourselves off the hook by thinking that thought. So we have to be careful about the thoughts we're thinking in terms of really deconstructing them, understanding what we're saying. But the first step is to hear it. So step one is to hear it. Step two is to do the thing you said might not work, but in fact can work, and that's to dispute that thought by saying no, but you have to say the no with the complete sentence there. No, you are not serving me. It's not no, you are not true, because as I say, many of these thoughts that aren't serving us may in fact be true. So you would say no, and I would say it louder than I want to. I don't want to scare your audience, but it would be a loud no. No, you're not serving me. And then the third step would be to substitute a more affirmative thought or a cognition that really works for us. It might be, I'm perfectly fine, or I'm getting right to the work, or whatever is the next right thing to say, that's what you would say. So, excuse me. So that's the three-step process, which can work, and is just noticing what you're thinking, disputing those thoughts that don't serve you, and then substituting more affirmative thoughts.
Thank you. That, again, is really valuable, Eric. I can imagine, say we were working on step eight, resilience, which I feel is so important. It seems like the calmness, clarity, awareness, courage, presence, not so much the courage, but the presence and the clarity and the calmness all kind of relate to that mindfulness aspect.
It does. And let's stay on resilience for one second. What's a thought that can get a person down? It can be, I can't deal with this anymore. Or I can't deal with this again. Mm-hmm. Right? This is where you would want to hear that thought and dispute it by saying, no, that's not serving me, because I do have to deal with this. And so the thought you might substitute is, I am going to deal with this, only differently this time. So if you hear a thought like, I can't deal with this, you have to dispute that thought. You can't act like you, in fact, can't deal with this, because you have to find the way to deal with it. There may be dramatic ways to deal with it or simple ways to deal with it, but one way or another, you don't want to just be abused by the situation. You do want to figure out what to do. So that's a place where the idea of resilience and the idea of right thinking coincide. One aspect of resilience is noticing those thoughts that make you feel not resilient and disputing them, and then substituting thoughts that encourage you, that give you hope, that alert you to the fact that there's something you had better try, because doing nothing can't be the answer.
In my own therapy that I've been doing, I've been working on for quite some time something called distress tolerance, which really is just building up resilience to the stuff that comes our way and stresses us out. And one of the things that really helped me was to remember, rather than thinking, oh, I can't deal with this, or here this is again, oh my gosh, this is so stressful, which are all true feeling thoughts, I'd look at it as, okay, well, this sucks, but it's another opportunity to practice resilience, to get improve that muscle.
That's exactly it. And either in this book or another book, it's hard for me to remember, but I think it might be in this book, I have an exercise which is called something like tolerating a difficult thought for 10 seconds. You know, most people can't tolerate difficult thoughts. And you were talking about toleration. It's a really big point, because the nanosecond we come close to having one of these difficult thoughts, maybe I really need a divorce, or his abuse is not okay, or whatever the difficult thought is, we run away from it because we don't want to deal with the consequences of the thought. So it takes a lot of courage to stay put with a thought. And as I say in this book or another book, to stay with it for a full 10 seconds. If you can tolerate a difficult thought for a full 10 seconds, you're going to actually hear it, and you're going to actually start dealing with it.
Can you say more about that, Eric? Because I think, I mean, as soon as we think a thought, then there's all these other story thoughts that come around it. So what exactly does it look like to sit with that thought for 10 seconds?
Well, let's take one like, I really need a divorce. So let's say you're only half saying that to yourself, or not quite saying it. It's sort of just out of conscious awareness, but you refuse to think about it because you have children together, because there would be all kinds of financial consequences, because all the reasons we could name why you don't actually want to look that thought in the eyes, so to speak. What tolerating it would mean would be that you would get to deal with the issue sooner rather than later. And that's a big headline. And I want to give you a big parenthesis here. I was the host for a video conference a while back in support of a book of mine called Life Purpose Bootcamp. And I interviewed a lot of people who sort of had their life purpose menus pretty clear in their lives and understood their meaning, needs, and how to meet them, etc. But for each one of these, let's call them fairly evolved people, for each one of these folks, a moment had come in their lives where the meaning had completely drained out of what they were doing in life. One was a college professor, and he just could no longer tolerate teaching his classes. Another woman was a nun, and she stopped believing in God and in her order and could hardly tolerate her day-to-day existence. And what really surprised me, it surprised me that each person I interviewed had one of these existential extremities, but it also surprised me how long it took them to make some movement, even though the meaning had completely drained out of what they were doing. And for each one of them, it took on the order of 5 or 6 years to make the change that they knew they were going to make in that first instant.
Wow.
So they were standing there, sitting there, being there, living there in distress for those 5 or 6 years, not able to use a sort of terrible metaphor, not able to pull the trigger on the change. What looking a thought in the eye for those 10 seconds means is that you're bound to make the change that you know you're going to make sooner rather than later. Maybe it'll still take you a full year to get the divorce you need, but that's still better than it taking 5 or 6 years to get the divorce. So I think that in part is what it looks like, is that you're bringing on the next maybe upgraded stage of your life more quickly by staying put and looking at these thoughts in the eye.
Thank you for giving us those examples, Eric, because I can imagine someone having a thought like, I need a divorce. Then there's one of the things that probably makes us not willing to face that thought is that it's so drastic. The step between where you are right now and being divorced is huge.
It is. And yet the gap can be crossed in a split second sometimes. And the perfect evidence of that is an addicted person hitting bottom. Mm-hmm. You know, you're abusively drinking, You don't want anyone to tamper with your drinking. You've fought with everybody in your life about your drinking. Then you run your car into a tree, and as you're sitting there injured, you suddenly realize that your drinking's out of control. And you, the next day, enter into recovery and go to your first AA meeting. That happens from one second to the next. Now, we don't want it to have to happen by virtue of running into trees. But the fact that someone can change his or her whole orientation in a split second is actually big news. And that means that, to use both of our languages around tolerance or tolerating things, if we can tolerate the difficulty of some of these thoughts, we can perhaps move to the next place we need to get very quickly. And it may be much less dramatic and difficult than we think. I have an exercise that I used to do. I only work with clients nowadays via Skype and the phone and email. But in the old days, I had an office like therapists used to have. And one of the ways I would teach courage and making these kinds of big moves easily, I had two little scatter rugs. And I'd have a client stand on one scatter rug, and the other scatter rug would be maybe 6 inches away. And I'd have the client visualize that 6 inches as a huge, deep gorge, thousands of feet deep, completely scary gorge that no person in their right mind would, you know, want to entertain trying to cross. And then I'd have the client just cross those 6 inches because it was only 6 inches. So much of the fear was about the depth of the gorge, but one didn't have to experience any of that depth. One had to just cross over 6 inches. So we have to be careful about over-dramatizing what the difficulties may be. Often there are real difficulties. I don't want to minimize real difficulties, but we also over-dramatize the difficulties. And the change that we need to make may be just like stepping over 6 inches, not like having to dive 20,000 feet without a parachute.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Eric. And also, I mean, we can make these huge changes in just a split second, like the example of hitting rock bottom, but also in the case of, let's say, a divorce, sitting with that thought of I need a divorce, and then, okay, what might my next step be?
Exactly.
How might I prepare myself? So maybe in the case of a woman who is completely financially dependent on her partner and has children and all of that, if she's not in immediate danger,
exactly,
her next step might be to start thinking about ways she could start making income, or ways, exactly, she could start learning the skills so that when she is ready to leave, she will be ready.
Exactly right. And another thing she can do, that's exactly right, maybe it's a home business or something that she can do for an hour each. She can build on the side, on the sly, so to speak, 1 hour a day at home on her computer. There are lots of, we know there are zillions of opportunities on the net nowadays. So that is one thing she could do, and that would be smart. Another thing she could do, and I teach all clients to try to do this, and that is to start to speak when it's important to speak, to start to speak in sentences of 7 words or fewer with a real period at the end of sentences. Because human beings tend to, as soon as they start adding commas and clauses, they tend to start half apologizing, half trying to take the sting out of what they just said, presenting another kind of agenda item on top of the first agenda item, and just not doing the real work of communicating when they do that. And it's very hard to say things in a few words with a strong period, because one feels how clear one is being when one does that, and that there are going to be consequences, because maybe suddenly for the first time you're actually being clear. So what does that sound like? It sounds like the following. That's not okay. And I'm pausing for effect. That's not okay, with a real period. Nothing else after that. If your husband or your son or your parent or your sibling or your this or your that, someone is doing something that's not okay, rather than launching into many sentences about what's not okay about that, strongly saying that's not okay with a period actually gets heard. Doesn't mean the other person's going to change. We understand that people don't necessarily change because of anything we try. We can't control other people. But this is the way we influence other people, is by saying strong things that can be heard.
I love that. I'm actually I have this deck of flashcards that I'm writing things on so that I can remember all these points that I am trying to learn. And that sentences of 7 words or less is going on the flashcard.
Yeah, it's amazing how powerful those sentences are. I mean, when things matter, I don't mean, you know, please pass the butter. I'm not talking about that. Although you would get the butter passed if you said it, you know. But almost all communications are more strongly received if we say them that briefly. I actually have, let me just for no particular reason, but I just want to add one point to that. I teach the creativity coaches I train a little ABC rule. It just connects to what we're talking about. And the B of the ABC rule is the brief right there, be brief. So the ABC is to be affirmative, brief, and clear. And I think if we just hold that as hallmarks of the way we want to communicate, we'll do a much better job of communicating in life, to be affirmative, brief, and clear.
Wow. Again, I'm writing that down. Well, that's one of the things I notice when I listen back to these radio shows, is how I'll start one thought and then I'm off onto another tangent of another. And I'm aware of the fact that I would be served by being more succinct. I think that 7 words or less rule, not for all communication, but for things that are important, is so valuable because, number one, it forces you to think, what is the main point here that I'm trying to communicate? And then when you do say it in few words, it's also showing, it's demonstrating awareness, courage, and calmness.
Exactly. And it just simply forces you to stop.
Yeah.
You know, if you're living by that rule, it forces you to stop. It forces you to stop doing those things that you're used to doing. Whatever the habitual extra words are about, it just forces you to stop. And I think people feel like instantly stronger, scary stronger sometimes, you know, because as we've said repeatedly, it can be frightening to actually realize that you're now going to say something where the message is going to be heard. That can be scary. You know, but that scariness aside, that's the way to operate, is saying things that strongly. It makes one feel strong to speak like that.
And what you said about the message being heard is so important, because there's so many times we try to communicate what we need or what we want, and we get into this blah, 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 dumping of emotion, and the listening party, after a few words, starts to tune out because it's overwhelming.
They tune up, and they're also, you know, we're clever, tricky, really tricky creatures. And so you're giving them the opportunity to address your 14th point, which is your least important point. But since you put out 14 points, you're giving the respondent the ability to go respond to something that was never your main point. So this is a way to provide no ammunition, no way. A person can't speak to when you say that's not okay, a person can't speak to the weather or bananas or anything else. They have to, if they're going to respond at all, they have to speak to the thing that's actually on your mind.
So the more words you give them, the more excuses they have, the more ways they have to divert from the actual point of the conversation.
Exactly. And because these are people who know us, they're waiting for us to put our foot in our mouth. Like, it's just waiting for us to say that third thing so they can go there. You know, they're going to stay perfectly blissfully quiet while you say thing one and thing two. They're just waiting for thing three so they can say, ah, well, you know, I really did fold my laundry this time, so I don't know why you're bringing up the laundry again. They're just waiting to go there because they know you.
Yep. And that's, oh, it's so maddening. I'm sure we've all been in that situation.
Well, I think so, because as we all know, nobody's trained in life skills. Very little what goes on either in elementary school or around the dinner table is really helpful in helping us learn any skills. So we have to learn this as adults. And let me just circle back around to my little theory of personality. I only mentioned the first part of the three parts, which was original personality. Second part I call formed personality, which is the way our personality sort of accretes over time. Now, the third part is what I call available personality. That's our remaining freedom to become the person we actually would like to be. Well, most people are stuck in their formed personality that's accreted over time. And so they just do things mindlessly and repetitively from their formed personality. It's why it's so important to notice and then enlist our available personality, because that's kind of all the freedom we have to become the person we'd actually like to be.
Hello, everyone. Is school stressing and is campus safety concerning you? Join UBC Tai Chi Club to de-stress and learn self-defense. Simply search UBC Tai Chi Club on Facebook to receive notifications about our lessons. See you there.
Oh, man.
What?
I really wanted to catch that football game, but I have to clean my room. I'm so bummed.
Yo, man, totally chill out. You can catch it on CITR.
CITR?
Did someone say CITR?
Yeah.
CITR Radio brings you Thunderbird Sports on the weekends. Catch all the action and don't miss a moment of play with our live play-by-play and color commentary. Only on CITR 101.9 FM.
Wow, that's great.
And if you can't catch the game, tune in at 3:30 p.m. every Thursday for our weekly update on UBC Athletics with live scores, recaps, and in-depth analysis.
Oh, okay, dude. Okay, dude. We get it.
Dude!
Only on CITR.
I'm so glad that we're having this conversation today, Eric, because, first of all, we are speaking with Eric Maisel. We're talking about his latest book, Overcoming Your Difficult Family. And I feel like just in the last few minutes that we've been speaking, there are so many nuggets of wisdom that listeners can implement right now today. So if you are from a difficult family and you're challenged with that difficult family, you may want to check out Eric's book, Overcoming Your Difficult Family. And as Eric pointed out, rather than trying to work on everything, which is how we kind of get scattered in life, pick what is the most painful point here. What is something that might make the biggest difference in my life right now? Whether that's working on calmness, presence, resilience, choose one and work on that. Eric, do you have any more points for how people can either choose that or to focus on it?
Yeah, and it's sort of a big point, so it may wind us in some left field territories, but typically most people are not clear on life purpose and meaning. Because we have thousands of years of metaphors around seeking meaning and the purpose of life, most people don't realize that there is no purpose to life. This is my view. There are only our life purpose choices. Everybody gets to make idiosyncratic life purpose choices, but they have to make them in order to have life purposes. And there's no meaning to life. Meaning is, to my mind, a certain kind of psychological experience like joy or hatred. It's an unusual one, but it's a psychological experience that we can influence and create. We don't have to seek it. We don't have to go to the top of a mountain or follow some guru or find it in a book somewhere. We just notice what we've experienced as meaningful in life and maybe replicate those things so that we experience meaning again. What this means for me is that a large task for a person is to identify her life purpose choices, or to say that more simply, identify what's important to her. And then check in on a daily basis as to which of those life purpose choices you're going to get to on that day. Because let's say your menu has five or six items on it, like creativity and relationships and activism and service or whatever's important to you. On a given day, three quarters of the day may have to be spent in what I call meaning neutral, where you just do errands and tackle responsibilities and ought not to pester ourselves about the meaningfulness of life at those moments, because life may not be feeling that meaningful at those moments. So maybe we only have a fraction of the day to spend on our life purposes. But if we spend that fraction on our life purpose choices, we're already ahead of the game, because most people don't spend any time on their actual life purpose choices on a given day. That's all by way of saying, if you're trying to figure out how to deal with your family, we're trying to figure out what's the most important single choice to make, that might be to circle back around to this major question of what are my life purpose choices? Because if you can focus on your life purpose choices, that may start to minimize family difficulty. Your family may turn out to be less and less important to you or less and less problematic to you the more you're actually living your own life purpose choices. The more you're living a purposeful, intentional life, the less those family difficulties may actually affect you.
Thank you, Eric. And that actually, when we were having the discussion about the thought about I need a divorce, I think that what sometimes happens is someone thinks I need a divorce, and then they start working on their own happiness and their own life as a way to prepare for divorce. And what happens is that they become a happier person, and that influences the people around them, and they end up not needing a divorce.
Absolutely. All kinds of things happen. They decide to lose that 20 pounds so that they're more attractive for their prospective next mate, and all of these. We could name 20 things that they start to do. And so maybe they get happier, maybe they also get healthier, etc. So that's right. Focusing on hearing something as big as I need a divorce, and then beginning to circle back around to, okay, what's really important to me in life? It's clearly not this guy or this woman. They're still important. They're still influential in my life because they're still here. But I can see that I'm going to be making a change. So given that I'm going to be making a change, what do I want to announce as my next set of life purpose choices? Because, by the way, our life purpose choices change over time. You know, we could, in one moment before a war our country is fighting for all kinds of reasons we could name, and then maybe we learn more about that war and suddenly decide that we're against that war now because we've learned X, Y, and Z. So huge things in our lives can change. That's how life is. That's very disturbing and disruptive when something like that changes. It's kind of like an earthquake. But nevertheless, that's a mature attitude, is to understand that our life purpose choices may change over time, depending on our new opinions, depending on changed circumstances, for all kinds of reasons.
Beautiful. Yeah, it can be. And even just getting one new piece of information can change the way we view. As one example, I started learning about communication between men and women from a woman named Alison Armstrong. And her view, one of the big things that she teaches, is that everything that men do, or everything that people do, we all do for what we feel is a good reason. And as soon as you start looking at, well, what might be the reason that this person is behaving like such a jerk right now, in our perception, and asking, would you mind telling me why you're doing that? Their reason could totally change your view of that person.
Exactly. And, you know, it brings to mind, I'd like to tell just one story from my practice. I'm not sure why exactly this comes to mind, but somehow it seems interesting to me at this moment. Mm-hmm. I was working with sort of about identifying what really are the issues going on in life. I was working with a lawyer who presented as his issue that he was working too much. He was working, you know, 90-hour weeks or whatever, and he had his reasons for that. He was up for partnership, and the partners needed him to be working at a maximum, and his bonuses were based on billable hours and all of that. So for a long time, I would say for 3, 4, 5, 6 sessions, we were sort of problem-solving how to reduce his hours at work in the context of him not really figuring out a way to reduce those hours. Finally, I'll make this long story short, finally it came out that the reason he was working all these hours had nothing to do with work, or not that much to do with work, but the fact that he was scared to go home. Mm. That is, he was scared to look the badness of his relationship with his wife in the eye. So he was finding ways to minimize the amount of time he would spend at home. So he would work all of these hours, then he wouldn't go home. Then he would go to the gym. Then he wouldn't go home. Then he would go to another office he had to work on a law book. Finally, exhausted at whatever, 11 p.m. or some ridiculous hour, he'd go home and maybe his wife would already be asleep, as would his kids. So he was hardly seeing his kids. This is all by way of saying family relationships are exactly this complicated. And to piggyback on what you were saying, until we could actually get at his reasons for all of that work, just focusing on the work was going to make no impact because it just wasn't the real thing. It wasn't really about work. It was about something else.
And it's so often that we think the thing that is most obvious to us is the problem. Like, okay, well, I need to lose weight. That's the most obvious thing when I look at myself in the mirror. But what are the underlying reasons that I've chosen to eat the way that I do? And to, you know, maybe a lot of people find out when they have lost weight that that wasn't the root issue.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And I've spent a lot of time on exactly that issue. I did a book called Life Purpose Bootcamp, but then I followed that up with a book called The Life Purpose Diet, which looks at losing weight in the context of life purpose choices and meaning needs. Because you're right, it's hardly ever just about losing the weight or how I look. It has to do with avoiding other kinds of life purpose choices, avoiding answering our meaning needs, etc. It's often the eating is a meaning substitute. It's a substitute for doing the hard work of figuring out how to actually meet our meaning needs.
But it goes back to, like we were talking about with the 7-word rule, our minds are so good at diverting and finding the distracting issue rather than the root issue.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, several of the skills sort of sound alike: awareness and clarity and smarts. They sound, and they are, they're in the same family. All of them speak to the issue that we are very defensive, tricky creatures who, as best as we can manage, try to avoid awareness and clarity and smarts. You know, Freud had many odd ideas and ideas that have not held up to scrutiny, but I think the idea that he had that's held up the best, and it's the one, parenthetically, that his daughter Anna pursued her whole life, was the idea of defenses, the idea that we are defensive creatures and that we have all kinds of defenses, not just the one that you hear spoken about in AA, namely denial, but rationalization and projection and intellectualization. There are probably 20 different ways in which we are tricky. And since there are so many ways in which we are tricky, it makes sense that we're going to have to spend more than a split second to get clarity on any particular issue.
Well, Eric, I'm sure we could talk all day about this. We are speaking with Eric Maisel. He is the author of many books. He mentioned Life Purpose Bootcamp. The book we're talking about today is Overcoming Your Difficult Family. You can find him at ericmaisel.com or just Google Overcoming Your Difficult Family. And we are almost out of time. I'm wondering, Eric, what you feel if we've had so many valuable pieces of implementable wisdom here today, but if there's just one thing that a listener can take home today, what would that be for you?
Well, this may be not exactly the top one or the only one, but it just comes to mind, and that is, we've been talking about lots of things, but I want to mention that number one is to be safe in your family. If your family is dangerous, that's not okay. And so if you're not feeling safe, you would want to look for and try to find allies, maybe in your extended family, maybe a grandmother or an aunt or an uncle or a cousin, because we can go a little odd in the head. We can get a little crazy if nobody is validating our feelings, if nobody is acting as if what we're experiencing is true. That's where maybe an extended family member can help with that. But just as a headline, make sure that you're safe in your family. That comes first.
Thank you, Eric. And I just as a final thought, I'm wondering if you could go back and talk with a younger version of yourself, is there a piece of advice that you might give him?
Well, I'm pretty happy with my journey. The only advice would be to be less arrogant, grandiose, and narcissistic sooner. Because that's certainly the place I started from, and it was a journey to reduce some of those features of personality. My phrase for that sort of work is upgrading your personality. It took me a little while to upgrade my personality. So in keeping with what we were talking about before, I would just maybe would like to have done that a little sooner rather than later.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much for your time, Eric. Again, we've been speaking with Eric Maisel. You can find him at ericmaisel.com or Google Overcoming Your Difficult Family, or also the other book mentioned, Life Purpose Bootcamp. Thank you to Eric for his valuable time and for all of those bits of wisdom that we can just use right now. My favorite so far, I think, is the 7-word limit.
I know. You're going to try that out, I know.
Absolutely. Hopefully it will help improve the show as well. And thank you so much for listening, for being with us, and for sharing this hour with us. I want to send you lots of love. Be well. Namaste. Up next is Parts Unknown with DJ Chris Arific on CITR.
UBC Women in Science Club provides support for female undergraduates in science fields. Our club has 3 pillars, mentorship, building community, and connecting people. We offer networking events with alumni, professional development workshops, as well as an ongoing mentorship program to support students through challenges that arise for women pursuing careers in science.
Hey UBC students, love doing arts and crafts or just making things in general? We've got you covered. The AMS Print Club works to bring you crafts from different cultures, backgrounds, and decor styles. We aim to bring about cultural and environmental awareness through the arts and crafts. Check out our Facebook page, Print Arts and Crafts, or email us at printartscraftsclub@gmail.com for more details.
All right, I'm gonna do it wrong. I'm about to spit in this mic like freestyle elfin, you know?
Okay. Wait, hold on. Does this make sense?
No, but who cares? All right, let's go. Finally, we... You're not even gonna last. All right. Victoria's pretty good, not bad festival, fountain, just back from France... Montreal? What the f***? This is script. I couldn't even... What? Victoria's pretty good, not bad festival. Back from France. What are you even saying here? Oh, you're trying to say these are the things featured in this one. You should probably specify that. Because even a f***ing elf couldn't understand that, okay?
Think you can do better than an elf? At CITR, we want to have a variety of voices on the air. Want to write scripts? Do some voice acting? Broadcast your creativity? Volunteer with the CITR production department. No experience? We can also train you in everything required. Send an email to psas@citr.ca to learn more. And don't wait to get your voice on the air.
Stew's the stew for you. Do you do the stew that stews? Come find out at UBC Sprouts.
Located in the basement of the AMS Nest and on the penthouse of the GSS building, open weekdays 9 to 4:30.
UBC Sprouts is your home for cheap,
tasty,
organic,
locally sourced,
vegan stew and baked goods.
If a search has been long and futile and brutal...
You know what's better than reading a great magazine? Reading a great magazine that also helps you fight poverty. Megaphone Magazine is sold by homeless and low-income vendors on the streets of Vancouver and Victoria. Vendors buy magazines for 75 cents and sell them for $2. It's flexible, low-barrier work for people who may not have access to traditional jobs. Download the Megaphone app to find vendors and buy the magazine, even when you don't have change.
Ladies and gentlemen, This is
an advertisement for
Finding the Funny
on CITR 101.9 Mondays 6 to 6:30. We'd love for you to tune in and check us out on Twitter at Finding Funny FM. Every week, host Nico McEwen talks about new comedy topics, whether it be stand-up, sketch comedy,